Father, I thank you for all the riches of your kingdom that you've given to us. And I thank you for life and breath, and I ask you, Father, for your help right now, that you would use me and do your will through me. And do that thing that Yeshua does. In Yeshua's name, amen. I would like to appoint someone today into the position of book remover. Permanently, or at least, you know, like the police commissioner serves at the pleasure of the ones in charge, until such time that would change. It's surprisingly easy to be a blessing. Did you know? Just if somebody just like took those away after the readings every week, that would bless me. And then it would be at least as good as giving a cup of water to the least of these. And if you do that, you shall by no means lose your reward, the scriptures say. I always find that to be pretty encouraging. So, I have something to present to you before the message, but, you know, everything's part of the message in some way or other. I'm going to try to cover this succinctly. I'm going to read you parts from Article 7 of the Constitution of the Congregation, which starts with B of that section. Any member or group of members may submit to the eldership names of individuals to serve as deacons. The eldership shall consider the qualifications of said individuals and upon approval, present them to the congregation at a Shabbat service. There will be a four-week period for input from members of the congregation commencing with the time of presentation by the eldership. After being examined by the members of the congregation and after the minimum of a four-week period has been completed, the nominated deacons thereafter, confirmed by the eldership, shall be set into office via the laying on of hands by the eldership at the first available Shabbat. And then another part of the same article, 7 from 7 to A. You all have it memorized, I imagine. The following terms shall guide appointments to roles of ministry: assistant congregational leader, assistant rabbi, or assistant pastor refers to one who is not an elder and does not have oversight and government over the congregation, but serves the specific assignments of the head elder and the eldership. And from the very end of the page that's on, the confirmation of the apostolic covering will be sought for such appointments before seeking the confirmation of members of the congregation. I'm going to start the rest of what I have to say about this with just a little story from the life of my brother James, who was in fact once the foreman of a construction company, but only he and his boss knew that. That created difficulties and misunderstandings. He also didn't get the pay, by the way. So it's kind of hard to direct and work in a capacity with people that's not understood or not clearly understood. Is that clear? So what eventually happened is that the owner of the company officially made and recognized my brother as the foreman. And after that, see, when people knew that he was actually the foreman, then whether they always liked it or not, they understood that the power behind the organization, which was the construction company, was actually vested in him to do that, fulfill that function of being a foreman. That's made things work much better. That makes sense? So, God is not the author of confusion, it says in 1 Corinthians 14:33. Anybody believe that? God is not the author of confusion. So, we've been having some discussions and received input, I guess, first from David Harwood, and then sought input from Dan Juster, Eitan Shishkoff, Gary Kivlowitz, and also the rabbis of the Northeast Regional Tikkun Council, two of whom are on the what's referred to as the apostolic team. And Dan Juster, of course, is the apostolic covering of Tikkun. So after talking about these things, what I'm talking about really is my wife's role in the congregation. And it might be obvious to many of you that she functions in a number of different capacities. Is that obvious to anybody? I don't know if I could list them all right now without having them on a piece of paper in front of me. I have such a piece of paper, but not in front of me. She counsels people. She disciples women. She does administrative work. It's hard to even cover it in a brief description. So, I don't know if I should even get into where I'd be without her. So, I think what I'm trying to say is so here's the thing. My wife functions, in fact, as a deacon. Anybody that thinks about it probably knows that. She's also much more than a deacon. And I don't know, if I asked you if you thought my wife was the assistant rabbi, what would you say? Did I hear yeses? Yeah,
ask what you meant by rabbi.
Oh, that's a good question. Assistant to the rabbi.
That's what the term basically means.
What?
The term basically means assistant rabbi is the assistant.
So, you know, I've made some comments recently. You know, there's a lot of controversy and confusion and disagreement about women. You know, have you noticed that women make up a huge portion of the population? I believe that there really is no area of ministry that's not open to women other than, according to the scriptures, authority over congregations. It matters how things get delineated, and I'm not going to try to iron every wrinkle out today. But I think really what's been happening is my wife has been functioning in many ways without it being properly recognized for a long time. In some cases, people don't understand that or haven't understood that, and that actually impedes her ability to function, and it also impedes people's ability to understand what's happening. It, you know, you can end up with like what happened to my brother in some cases. Well, who are you? Or what do you think you are? You know, and not being recognized in a capacity you're functioning in actually impedes your ability to freely operate in it. So, I may not get I may not get all of this quite right, but as you noticed when I was reading, the term assistant rabbi is defined in our Constitution as not a governmental position. That would mean then, for instance, you know, and some of the things Paul wrote aren't that easy to understand. Like he says, women shouldn't speak. I'm not so sure that he was saying a woman should never say anything when a congregation gathers together. Does anybody think that's what he was saying? I think he was really talking about disorder among the Corinthians. You hope not. If the members of the congregation want to make comment on the subject of, as far as I'm concerned, whether or not my wife is and has been a deacon for a long time and should be actually recognized as functioning in that capacity, I guess you got 4 weeks to make comments. In fact, yes. I don't know how many questions I... direct them to me. By email, in person, over the phone. Yes.
There's another question.
Yeah.
Small one. Are you putting forth that your wife should be a deacon or assistant rabbi or a David Payne thing?
Good question. No, they're not the same thing. Thanks for asking that, actually. So, thing is, we haven't had any deacons for some time. There have been various reasons for that. I'd like to see more deacons. I mean, whether we need, you know, there are different views on deacons. I encounter them within Tikkun. But I think that at this point, recognizing anyone else as a deacon before my wife is clearly understood to be one and to have been one for really a long time would be out of order. And I don't want to get into a discussion about all of this today. That wasn't my purpose. So, yes, she would be officially set in as a deacon. My desire with the agreement of all these people who give us counsel is that recognizing her in the position of assistant rabbi would be proper and right to do. And beyond that, she really is... what Tikkun is now referring to some women as ministers of the gospel. They've ordained them as such so that it can be understood that women can in fact minister, but that's not that term does not mean head of a congregation or in authority over men or anything like that. So these are things that I wanted to present to you today so that they could become clear. People can ask any questions or express anything they like to me and to Dan Juster and to David Harwood. If you would like to ask questions, they're available. If you don't know how to contact them, I can tell you. So... there's a month period. Okay. I'm not very good at judging time. You what? Well, it is clear that a number of people have essentially had that thought. So, yeah, I actually think it's kind of a travesty that this has not ever come up in some clarity before. One thing I believe is that just clearly stating certain things and making them plain will actually free us both up to function in the capacities that we really are meant to function in more easily, both together and with the congregation. So, did I miss anything? Maybe. Was that confusing? Oh, yes, they do. Yeah, sorry. I'm not even sure why I did that.
So,
right. That was, did I make that clear? It is not an ordination as an elder. It's not being the head of a congregation. It's not being given governmental authority over congregations or portions of congregations. That's not the issue. I do, by the way, think that people in different capacities have different levels of what I would call some authority. Deacons, for instance, when they were first set in by the apostles, some people think of it as, waiting on tables. Well, you know, that was what was said. Hey, it's not right that we, the apostles speaking, spend our time waiting on tables when we have the job God's given us. So they set these deacons in place. And so what they did was they actually governed a distribution of food and aid to different people, because what was happening is some people were being neglected because of what ethnic group they were from. And that was causing dissension and trouble and complaints. And so they were set in place. Actually, it's a very difficult position they were in. They had to govern how those things were done so that it was done equitably. And as you might imagine, when some people get equity, they don't always feel that it's equitable. They might think they should be getting something better or more than that. They had to regulate all these disputes and tensions so that there was peace. And I would call that, I would say that they were given some authority to occupy that position and fulfill the need of it. So, words like authority and woman seem to be very controversial and problematic sometimes. Maybe man is too. And I actually think that in our present day and age, the confusion is getting worse and worse, and all the more things need to be clarified. Because in an odd way, I mean, all distinctions of any kind are being removed in our society. It's the denial of any difference between this thing or that thing or this person or that person. And the solution isn't, it's not a worldly solution. It's a godly solution. And I think you never advance the kingdom of God by functioning in a way where any group of people is in some way impeded or denied the rightful function that God has given them. So really, this is largely just about clarity and clarity over confusion and the freedom to operate in what one's called to do. And I believe that this will actually help in terms of everyone functioning in the way that they should. Has everything been clarified well enough at the moment? That's fine, I guess. I mean, is there any... I shouldn't have said everything. That's a pretty big... Everything's a pretty big word.
The what?
Yeah. Okay, so, so moving on. I want to take a look at I was thinking earlier, and I thought, well, maybe the title of the message should be You have not but slumbered here. You recognize that line? Part of a line from, well, only part of it, from Puck in A Midsummer Night's Dream. There are dreams, and then there are dreams. This current section of the Torah has been dealing with the life of Joseph. He was, a dreamer. I don't know why I can't focus on you today. It's better than with nothing, but what is a dreamer? What's a dreamer? Doesn't always mean the same thing in one context or another. Sometimes it's an insult, isn't it? When Joseph's brothers referred to him as a dreamer, they were not being in anything close to complimentary. There's a way in which, well, let me make sure I don't get ahead of myself. Anyway, I asked you, how would you define a dreamer? What?
One who has dreams.
One who has dreams. We're getting really succinct here. We could have a dream without being a dreamer, I suppose. Anyway, do any of you have a dream? If I asked you if you thought God is a dreamer, what would you say? I'm hesitating myself as I'm thinking about it.
Yes.
Yes, although Yeshua did sleep. He got up in the morning, he went to bed at night, maybe not every night. Yeah. Thank you.
And also, that
yeah, very good points. Someone that sees what at the moment isn't, but could be, and has hope for it. What? Yeah. Yeah. Sees what isn't and has hope for it being. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. My main thought really about a dreamer. Well, I mean, even dreamers that have just, you know, delusional dreams, they do it while they're awake, you know. It's not gone when they're awake. But in terms of having a dream of what could be but is not yet and having hope for it, and I'm talking about what should be, the primary occupation of that doesn't happen when one's sleeping, obviously. Hope would tend to drive someone toward realizing the dream. And so I want to just look at Joseph a little bit here. He was beloved by his father, right? His father really loved him and doted on him. His brothers hated him because they saw how much his father loved him, and that he loved Joseph more than them. They hated him. And so then he has these dreams, and Genesis 37:3 mentions how much, maybe I should just turn there, how much Joseph loved Jacob loved Joseph, and Joseph clearly loved his father. All right. Now Israel loved Joseph more than any other of his sons, because he was a son of his old age. And he made him a robe of many colors, but when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. Now Joseph had a dream, and when he told it to his brothers, they hated him even more. He said to them, Hear this dream I have dreamed. Behold, we were binding sheaves in the field, and behold, my sheaf arose and stood upright. And behold, your sheaves gathered round it and bowed down to my sheaf. His brothers said to him, Are you indeed to reign over us? So then later on, it's in the same chapter. A little bit farther along. So his father sends Joseph to look for his brothers and see how they're doing. And, of course, Joseph says, Here I am, and he does what his father asked him to do, so he goes looking. So when he found his brothers, they saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, Here comes this dreamer. Come now, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams. And so then it continues. Reuben sort of intervenes and says, Don't kill him, and he wanted to rescue him. They throw him into a pit. Then Reuben's away, and then it goes on. They sat down to eat, and looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, What profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh. And his brothers listened to him. Then the Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. So then he ends up in Egypt, and they think they've gotten rid of their problem. Sometimes I wonder how each of them felt after that, what they thought, just how easily they could tell the lies they told to their father, and then watching their father sink into a long-term, apparently, unconsolable grief. But we don't really know that much about just how they felt. It seems that they must have had pretty hard hearts to be able to do what they did. So anyway, as it goes on, the famine comes, and Joseph ends up in Egypt, and it says in the 39th chapter, Genesis 1, that God was with him. It says that again in the 5th verse, the 2nd and the 5th verse. And it says that all that he did was blessed. As you know, He's in Potiphar's house, and everything prospers there because of him. And then his master's wife takes a shine to him, wants to seduce him, but he won't have anything to do with it. And so she, being jilted, accuses him of molesting her. And he gets thrown into prison for all of his faithful service under completely unjust circumstances. And then in the prison, he continues to be faithful and just do everything he can do, and he gets put in charge of everything at the prison. And then he interprets dreams and is forgotten by the people he asked to make mention of him to Pharaoh. So there he is. You know, it doesn't really look like, when you study the life of Joseph, you can find any place where he did anything but his utmost best to be faithful in the service of whoever he was serving, even though he was serving under unjust circumstances, having been sold by his brothers, not deserving that treatment at all. And there is this concept in rabbinic Judaism of a Messiah called Messiah ben Yosef. That's the suffering Messiah or the suffering servant. And Joseph is the image of that type of Messiah. Then there's Messiah ben David, and that's the triumphant Messiah. And I think there's argument as to whether or not it's two or whether they are one, but I'm not an expert on everything that gets said about that in the Talmud. And very few people in the world are, by the way. But many know a lot more than I do. So here you are, finally, the cupbearer eventually remembers Joseph when Pharaoh begins to have dreams. He ends up interpreting Pharaoh's dreams. And because of the wisdom that God's placed in him, Pharaoh puts him essentially over all of Egypt. He's second only to Pharaoh. And it really seems like what happens is he's pretty much regulating everything. Pharaoh's still above him, but Pharaoh's not really doing the work of administrating or regulating anything. He's just sitting there being Pharaoh, and Joseph's running the whole country. That's what it sounds like, right? Pretty interesting. So then finally, you know, his family is in this famine, and they go down. And I'm not going to go through all the parts of the story. We talked about it a little bit this morning, but he puts his brothers through some tests. And then finally, he reveals himself. And then he tells them to go and tell their father of all his splendor in Egypt. You know, his brothers at that point, I think, had already bowed down to him. And at that point, they're finding out what happened to that dreamer and what became of his dreams. What did they find out? They found out that he'd been highly exalted, and that even unknowingly, they ended up bowing down to him, calling them his servants. He would say, "Your servant." You know, Judah spoke to him that way. And must have been quite a kicker at the point where he finally let them know who he was. And so, in the end, no matter what the intentions of the powers of darkness were, and what the intentions of the thoughts and actions of his brothers were, God's plan is what ends up being done, and Joseph's dreams come true in blazing color. And then he, as the betrayed brother, the one who came to his own and his own did not receive him, that was betrayed, sold into slavery. I mean, talk about a wound. He is the one that saves all of Israel. At the time, bringing them down and making provision for them, and he tells them that you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. If you ever really struggle over your own circumstances, I would suggest that a very close study of the life of Joseph and his suffering was really instructive of a lot of things. Have you ever noticed that nobody can undo God's will? Nobody can undo God's will for you or your life by making plans to get in your way, to kill you, or even, you know, just to get rid of you without it being quite so messy as outright murder. God's plans can't be undone by the plans of men, and they can't be undone by the plans of the evil one. It seems pretty clear in the scriptures that the evil one has this plan. He wants to, well, I would say destroy all of humanity. He wants to be God. He wanted to kill the Messiah. He's a liar and a murderer. That is what he goes about trying to do. But can anybody show me any place where what God set out to do was ever undone by the powers of evil? Can you? The powers of evil seem so powerful. God sent his son, and I think Yeshua seemed in some ways like a dreamer to a lot of people, but then he did things that were quite shockingly impressive that didn't fall under the heading of somebody just having a pipe dream. So then they got jealous. So the picture is very similar. The father loves the son. I'm going to turn to the Gospel of John. So, Yeshua says in John 3:35, the Father loves the Son and has given all things into his hand. Did it look at that point like all things have been given into his hand? He came to his own, and they regarded him as, a liar? A drunkard, or a glutton and a drunkard. I don't know if they called him a liar. Well, yeah, actually they did. And they became jealous of him. You think they were jealous of Yeshua because of how much the Father loves Yeshua? You think you can disconnect what happened from the whole story? I don't, actually. They were jealous of him. They wanted things their own way. And they set out to get rid of him. They set out to put an end to his claims, his dreams, right? They were going to put an end to it. They were going to take charge and get rid of him. So it says in the first chapter of John, he came to his own, and his own received him not. John 1:11. And his own, what did they do? They sought to kill him. John 5:18. I mean, you know all of these things from the Gospels, how they set about to kill him. And then one of those closest to him betrays him. And I don't know if the weight was the same, but sold him for 10 pieces of silver more than Joseph got sold for. I would say, I don't even want to say it. I don't like, let's see. a pretty low price, it seems. A pretty low price. So he's betrayed, he's sold, and just like Joseph, in the process of it all, he's turned over to the Gentiles for them to determine to do whatever they want with him, or so everyone thinks, right? You know, in the darkest part of the night and in the worst moments of life, the fulfillment of God's plan of redemption is taking place. And it is ever so hard for us as human beings to really keep that clearly in our minds when we're looking at what's going on around us, even inside of us, in our lives, in society. And that is what leads to things like people throwing up their hands and saying, well, there's no hope, all is lost. I mean, yeah, we're saved, but God... I mean, they don't say God has lost control. Well, some people do. But you can think it and act it without actually speaking outright that God can't handle what's going on. You can feel it. You can act like it. And you can, in fact, not really believe in terms of how you're proceeding with things that God is in control, that his plans cannot be thwarted, and that he's going to bring about his will. It perhaps is the single biggest struggle of human life, once one has come to faith, is to continually actually believe that God is going to do what he said he's going to do, that he's done it in you, that he'll do it in the world, that he'll fulfill his will for you, and that you will play your part in all of it finally coming to its consummation in Messiah at the end of time, which is the beginning of the age to come. So then, you know, at this really interesting point in the Gospel of John, Yeshua says something that's, it really just seems amazing, depending on your point of view, perhaps preposterous. He says this, so Judas has gone out to enact his betrayal. And then Yeshua says this when he had gone out. Now is the Son of Man glorified. What's about to happen? He's going to get arrested. He's going to get beaten. A bunch of people are going to tell a whole bunch of lies about him. Going to be mocked. And then his own people, a number of them, are going to start chanting, crucify him, crucify him, crucify him. And then the pathetic, gutless Pilate finally does what the people want because he's afraid. Another man that should have listened to his wife, actually. I mean, I find him a very compelling figure when I really think about him as a human being. It just hurts. It's just a lot of pain in it. He knew his decision was an unjust one. I guess he was just being political. So this is what's going on, and the statement of the Son of God is, now is the Son of Man glorified. and God is glorified in him. Is it possible for you to say something commensurate with that in your life when things look, well, I don't know if any of us have ever quite been in this circumstance or the one that Joseph was in, but it may be a difficult question to ask sometimes. What are we willing to go through that God be glorified? It's so easy to feel that we've been unjustly treated. And the cure of our indignation and complaint, and you know, they may be even valid complaints, is identification with the suffering of Messiah. There's never been an injustice in all of human history that even comes close to what humanity thought it was accomplishing by what it did to him. But in fact, Yeshua was in the process of being glorified through his humiliation, and the Father was going to be glorified in the midst of all of this horrible trial. And some of the betrayers, some of the people who wanted him dead and cried out such things as, crucify him, crucify him, in one fashion or another, would end up hearing the words, similar to Joseph, that you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good, that many lives might be saved. And any one of them that would hear that, regardless of the part they played, could have been redeemed. And I believe, I don't know how many, but I believe some of them must have been redeemed after the fact of seeking to kill him, to get rid of him, to have their own way instead of his way. So, spend some time looking at Yeshua. What does he look like? He's really what we should be looking at. He's why we're here. He's what we're about. Even when we've gotten confused, I mean, we just need to remember what we're about, what he's like, what he's made us to be. Long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. And he upholds the universe by the word of his power. This is the one that died for us, that redeemed us. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. I don't have any idea what it takes to keep the planets in their orbits, to hang one single star in the sky, let alone to make this globe that we're living on and then cover the whole thing with breathtaking beauty, from the tiniest little things to the largest things. Little grains of pollen that when magnified are just, it's just stunningly inexplicably marvelous. The colors, the shapes, every one of them so different. Every snowflake is different. I have no idea how many have fallen in the course of human history. And it just goes on and on. Little tiny insects that are so astoundingly beautiful, I can't even begin to absorb it, but yet I can experience it if I stop and look. It just sprawls on and on and on. And by the way, this is a life of wonder, no matter what's going on that's wrong in it, no matter what's been blighted by sin. Life is a wonder, and there's this wonder all around us, all the time. You don't have to look very far. So, this is Yeshua. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purifications for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the Majesty on high, having become as much superior to angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. For to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my son, today I have begotten you"? Or again, "I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son"? And again, he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, "Let all God's angels worship him." Of the angels, he says, he makes his angels winds, and his ministers a flame of fire. But of the Son, he says, "Your throne, O God, is forever and ever, and the scepter of uprightness is the scepter of your kingdom. You have loved righteousness and hated wickedness. Therefore, God, your God, has anointed you with the oil of gladness beyond all your companions. And you, Lord, laid the foundation of the earth in the beginning, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you remain. They will all wear out like a garment, like a robe. You will roll them up like a garment. They will be changed." Right there in the beginning of Hebrews, in the first 12 verses, you have from the beginning of time to the end of time, and it's all filled up with the character and majesty of Yeshua and the love of the Father for the Son and the love of the Son for the Father. It's absolutely breathtaking. And I defy you to be despondent if you look at Yeshua. Keep your eyes on him. He is all in all. And and he is abundant proof that no power in heaven and earth can take you out of God's will or defeat you in his purposes for you. So, nothing can separate us from God's love in Messiah. Nothing. And so, he will fulfill your purpose. And there's joy in the journey. You're all so precious. Lord, I ask you to just breathe on us, Lord. Show us Yeshua. Fill us with joy unspeakable, Lord. That's what you've given. Purpose and meaning and hope. A dream, hope to dream of what doesn't seem to be the hope that it will be, and to see your Son, the guarantee that it shall be completely fulfilled. We thank you so much, Father. In Yeshua's name.